overall, Monsignor Meyer is one of the world's leading New Testament scholars and arguably, I would argue, the world's leading scholar in historical Jesus studies. For those of you not familiar with the topic, historical Jesus scholarship seeks to understand the life and times of the first century man called Jesus of Nazareth. It uses all the tools available to modern historical research, including literary studies, archaeological discoveries, sociological insights, and so on, to know as much as we can about what we call the Jesus of history. And A Marginal Jew, his great work, is an exemplar of careful and faithful scholarship on this topic. On a personal note, let me say that Monsignor Meyer's work has been invaluable to me as a Christian, a Catholic, a Jesuit, a priest, and lately a writer about Jesus. The first volume of A Marginal Jew, The Roots of the Problem and the Person, which lays out the various criteria used by historical Jesus research and provides a wonderfully concise précis of Jesus' life, including a fascinating examination of what we can know about his hidden life, changed the way I looked at Jesus. To my mind, it is the single best volume written on the historical Jesus. All four volumes, however, of A Marginal Jew are stunning in their scope, their detail, their mastery of languages, cultures, and scholarship, as they carefully sift all the important evidence regarding aspects of the historical Jesus. And, rare for an academic book, all four volumes are well-written, lively, and as an added benefit, the footnotes are just as illuminating as the main text. The footnotes are just spectacular. Through his careful scholarship, Monsignor Meyer has helped countless people, students and scholars, the doubtful and the devout, Christians and non-Christians, to better understand the world from which Jesus came, the milieu in which he carried out his public ministry, and the Jewish background of his times. Therefore, he has helped countless people to come into closer contact with the Son of God. We are so honored to welcome him here tonight and look forward to hear him speaking about the parables. Please join me in welcoming Monsignor John Meyer.
Thank you, Jim, very much for that very generous, over-generous, knowing my own faults, that very, very generous and kind introduction. And I'd also like to thank all of you for coming out and spending your time this evening on a night that is a pivotal turning point in American history. But enough about David Letterman's last show. I am certainly especially pleased to be here this evening precisely because this lecture is sponsored jointly by America Magazine and the American Bible Society. By a happy coincidence, both institutions played a role in my early intellectual development. Attending the parochial school of St. Rita of Cascia in the old South Bronx in the early 1950s, I didn't receive a great amount of mind-expanding intellectual stimulus from my immigrant blue-collar environment. One happy exception was a priest educator who would visit the parish on Sundays to help out. On one auspicious Sunday, the pastor proudly announced from the pulpit that our visiting priest had published an article in America Magazine, which was sold in the back of the church. So I pestered my parents to buy a copy. It is hard today to conjure up the startling new world that opened up for an 11-year-old Bronx boy as I devoured the entire issue of America. I was astonished to learn that it was actually an intellectual dimension to Catholicism. Who knew? Fast forward some 8 years to my Cathedral College Greek professor, who ordered all of us Catholic boys to march down to the American Bible Society on Broadway and buy a copy of Nestle's Greek-Latin New Testament. Now, remember, this is before Vatican II, and so it was with some, dare I say, trepidation, that a still quite narrow 19-year-old found his way to what seemed to be alien territory. I can still remember this second experience of a new world opening up when I read the English introduction to the Nestle New Testament as I rode back on the subway to the safety of the South Bronx. It was a different world. It's, by the way, that tattered text of Nestle still sits on my bookcase in my office, Notre Dame, and I brought it tonight as a protective talisman, sort of the Protestant version of miraculous medal, maybe, I don't know. And it is a much newer edition, now the 28th edition of Nestle Allen's Greek New Testament that I also brought here with me this evening, the old and the new, you might say, my celebration of my own myth of the eternal return. Hence, I wish to dedicate this lecture to both America Magazine and the American Bible Society. In different ways, these two great institutions mark the beginnings of my own intellectual pilgrimage. A good part of this pilgrimage, as Father Jim mentioned, has been my work on the historical Jesus, embodied in what will soon be 5 volumes of A Marginal Jew. The funny thing is that in the beginning, A Marginal Jew was supposed to be a single volume. So by the time I was writing volume 5, I made a solemn vow with clenched teeth. Volume 5 would be the last volume. If a Pentateuch was good enough for Moses, it's good enough for me. Give me that good old time religion. Volume 5 was supposed to encompass the 3 final enigmas surrounding the historical Jesus: the riddle speech of his parables, the riddle speech of his self-designations, a better label than titles, and the final riddle of his death. But then, for better or for worse, in a moment of weakness, after finishing my treatment of the parables, I sent the fragmentary manuscript off to my editors at Yale University Press for some sort of initial feedback to make sure I wasn't going totally off the track. Unfortunately for my vow, my editors declared my approach to the parables to be revolutionary. It would shake up the whole field. Those words, not mine. When you start believing your own PR, you're dead. Hence, my editor said, my work on the parables needed to be published now as volume 5, with volume 6 to follow. At first, I resisted. Enough was enough. But after some Roman flea market bargaining, it's not for nothing, I was educated in Rome, I agreed to a volume 5 dedicated solely to the synoptic parables of Jesus. In the end, it may have been for the best. We always comfort ourselves with such thoughts. If the parables had been squashed into another doorstop-sized volume, along with Jesus' self-designations and his death, the parables might have had a hard time vying for attention. As a separate volume, the parables with my maverick thesis about them, you might say my Sarah Palin thesis about them, will not get lost in the crowd. And what is this maverick thesis? In a sense, it can be summed up in the not so accidentally provocative catchphrase, the big lie of Ulliker, Dodd, and Jeremias, the 3 great authors of parable books in the 20th century. This nutshell summation obviously begs for some elaboration. In fact, volume 5 begins by unfolding this basic thesis step by step in what I call, with a nod to Friedrich Nietzsche, 7 unfashionable theses. Taken together, they highlight what I consider to be the big lie of parable research, made possible by its unholy alliance with the quest for the historical Jesus. So let me unpack my nervy claim about the big lie by quickly running through my 7 unfashionable views or theses on the parables, moving from the least controversial to the most. Thesis 1 is almost like my end of 4 year 100 thesis STL exam at the Gurion University. You just had this endless list of theses you had to defend. Much easier tonight, only 7 instead of 100. Thesis 1 is fairly obvious, though often passed over in silence. New Testament scholars widely and wildly disagree on how many parables of Jesus there are in the Synoptic Gospels, that is to say, in Mark, Matthew, and Luke. The reason for this disagreement is simple. Scholars do not agree on what constitutes a parable of the Synoptic Jesus. We just use the words, let's not stop to define them. To give some examples, popular mainline books on the parables range from 29 parables to 65 parables, with a recent German compendium clocking it in at 104 parables, including, as it does, the Coptic Gospel of Thomas and other apocryphal works. Behind this grand variation lies a further disagreement on how we moderns distinguish between simple metaphor, a similitude, and a full-grown parable. Probing the reason for this fuzziness in terminology leads us back to the wide range of meanings found in the Hebrew noun mashal and its standard Greek translation parabole, from which, of course, we get parable. Actually, the difficulty of defining the meaning of parable reaches all the way back to complex arguments over the roots of different Hebrew verbs. Now, I promise you I will not drag you through the history of Hebrew verbs tonight. I simply report that the verb from which our Hebrew noun for parable comes, mashal, can carry two very different meanings that often get confused. On the one hand, to recite a proverb. On the other hand, to make a comparison. We're not surprised, then, that the Hebrew noun, mashal, is also confusing in its breadth of meaning. In various places in the Old Testament, it can mean proverb, axiom, aphorism, wise saying, riddle, comparison, similitude, an object of mockery, a song of mockery, and a byword. Talk about a big CV. Once again, behind this spectrum of meanings lie two basic meanings. On the one hand, a proverb or wise saying. On the other hand, a comparison or a similitude. And those are not the same things. Contrary to what a number of scholars claim, these two basic meanings point in different directions. The book of Proverbs contains many proverbs that do not involve any comparison or metaphor. And metaphorical statements are not necessarily proverbs. Not surprisingly, we find this full range of different meanings of mashal throughout the wisdom literature of the Jewish scriptures. What is not often noticed, though, is that New Testament commentators often jump, somewhat hastily, I think, from this wisdom context of mashal to Jesus' use of parables in the Synoptics. Therein lies a basic mistake that muddies the waters of New Testament parable research. It is to dispute this leap of logic that I pose thesis 2. Thesis 2 states that the wisdom mashal of the Jewish scriptures is not the prime source or analog of those parables that are most characteristic of, the parables that are most particular to, the synoptic Jesus within the New Testament. Notice my language here. The parables that are characteristic of and particular to the synoptic Jesus. Therefore, I'm not talking about one or two-line proverbs, aphorisms, similitudes, literary genres that are found in the Gospel of John, the Epistles of Paul, the other New Testament books. Though interestingly, none of those usages in the other books of the New Testament are ever labeled parabole, parable, already an indication that word is beginning to mean something more specific in the Synoptic Gospels. The parables peculiar to the synoptic Jesus are metaphors or similitudes that have been stretched out into short stories with at least an implicit beginning, middle, and end. In other words, mini narratives with at least an implicit, sometimes an explicit, plot line. Now, by way of a brief justification of this initial definition of synoptic parable as narrative parable, I would underline two facts. First, this narrative type of mashal is the literary form that is most frequently designated by the Greek noun parabole, parable, in the synoptics. Other meanings of parabole, proverb, puzzling ruling about Jewish law, the meaning of similitude, are scattered, infrequent, often they occur only once. Regularly, parabole in the synoptics means this narrative parable characteristic of only Jesus in the New Testament. Second, this narrative type of mashal is, as I say, the kind of parable speech that is unique to the synoptic Jesus throughout the entire New Testament. Nobody else uses narrative. They use similitudes, they use similes, they use aphorisms, proverbs, everything. Nobody else in the New Testament does parabole in the sense of a narrative parable. While these narrative parables are widespread in all three synoptic gospels, they are totally, notably absent in the rest of the New Testament, including the Gospel of John. I am the good shepherd is not anything like a synoptic parable. Jesus is not like a shepherd with 100. He is the good shepherd. He's the only shepherd. He's the platonic archetype in John's platonic universe. That is something totally different from the parables of Jesus in the synoptic gospels. And the same thing is true, the total lack of narrative parables elsewhere in the New Testament. Even the Greek noun parabole is absent from the rest of the New Testament, with the exception of two occurrences in the Epistle to the Hebrews, where it means some sort of platonic archetype. Now, what is often not noticed is that the analog of Jesus' narrative parables is found nowhere in the wisdom books of the Jewish Bible. That's a false source for trying to get at the narrative parables of Jesus. Rather, the analog is found primarily in what Jews call the former and latter prophets of the Old Testament, not the writings, which of course include the wisdom books. Granted, some of the parables in the former prophets are not spoken by figures we would call prophets in particular, but in the former prophets, certainly the most famous example of a narrative parable is found in the mouth of a prophet, namely Nathan, who speaks the judicial parable of the poor man who had his ewe lamb stolen by the rich man to accuse King David of his adultery, Bathsheba, and his killing of the husband, Uriah. You are that man. A prophet appears again as a teller of judicial parable to a king in the first book of Kings when King Ahab is rebuked by a prophet using a narrative parable. However, there is one curious disconnect between these parables in the former prophets and those of Jesus. None of these narrative parables in the former prophets, even Nathan's great comparative narrative, is ever labeled a mashal, a parable in its immediate literary context. This disconnect leads us to thesis three. Thesis three notes that it is in the writing prophets, also called the latter prophets, the prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, it is there that we find first both a notable expansion of the genre of comparative short story used in arguments about Israel's history, and second, the use of mashal vocabulary to designate this type of speech, this narrative parable. A prime example of the development of the genre in a judicial context is the famous Song of the Vineyard in Isaiah 5, 1-7. But even here, the story is called a shir, a song. I will sing a song of the vineyard, not a mashal, interestingly. It is rather in Ezekiel, the most bizarre psychedelic prophet and the cabin. It is rather in Ezekiel that the metaphorical narrative addressing Israel with both warning of judgment and promise of blessing extends to its greatest length, often as a grand allegory. And it is in Ezekiel that this comparison by way of narrative is explicitly labeled a mashal, a parable. Indeed, leave it to Ezekiel. In various verses like Ezekiel chapter 17, verse 2, God orders the prophet, and here you excuse my over-literal translation of the Hebrew to get the point across. God orders Ezekiel, son of man, riddle a riddle, both verb and noun, riddle a riddle and parable a parable to the house of Israel. Here the verb mashal and its correlative noun mashal are used side by side, parable a parable, with the added specification that the allegorical narrative to follow has a riddle-like character, in the Hebrew, cheda, an enigma, a riddle. Interestingly, the Greek translation at this point translates the word riddle as narrative, underlining that the literary genre used to convey the puzzling comparison is a story, and that makes all the difference about what mashal means here. And Ezekiel, obviously, both using the verb and the noun, is at pains to point out this new use that he's making of mashal. In addition, Ezekiel's type of mashal also functions as a prophetic oracle foretelling Israel's future. It is intriguing that a very different type of prophet uses a mashal in the same way in a different section of the Jewish scriptures. Way back in the Pentateuch, the prophet Balaam, in the book of Numbers, chapters 23, 24, calls his symbolic oracle about Israel's future a mashal as well. In fact, Balaam yokes the noun mashal, parable, with another noun, na'um, a common word for a prophetic utterance or oracle. Thus, alongside the former and latter prophets, the Pentateuch gives an example of mashal, each time translated as parabole in the Greek, with the meaning of a prophetic utterance employing figurative speech in a narrative to prophesy Israel's future. What we have seen so far, then, in these first three theses taken together, forms the basis for the key step in my argument that we take in thesis 4. Thesis 4 states that the synoptic Jesus who tells the narrative parables stands primarily not in the wisdom tradition of the Jewish scriptures, but rather in the prophetic tradition of the Jewish scriptures. Hence, Jesus, the spinner of narrative parables, should be described not in terms of Jesus the sage or Jesus the wise man, but Jesus the prophet. This unfashionable assertion contradicts a large swath of parable research in the last 3 to 4 decades. From conservative exegetes like Ben Witherington to members of the far-left Jesus Seminar like John Dominic Crossan, the parables of Jesus have been treated as prime examples of Jesus as wisdom teacher or sage. In light of what we have just seen, there seems to be an error in assigning categories. As I have argued throughout the first 4 volumes of A Marginal Jew, the historical Jesus presented himself to his fellow first-century Palestinian Jews first and foremost as the miracle-working Elijah-like prophet of the end times. To be sure, Jesus taught proper legal observance in matters like divorce, oath-taking, Sabbath, and he spoke many a wisdom saying, law and wisdom being very much intertwined in the late Second Temple period. But as I have tried to show in all 4 volumes of A Marginal Jew, the category that integrates the most important aspects of Jesus' activity as well as its outcome is eschatological prophet. Developing the narrative mashal out of the tradition seen in the former and latter prophets, Jesus the prophet told striking short stories with figurative language meant to tease the mind into active thought and personal decision, all within the larger context of prophetic conflict with the ruling class at a critical moment in Israel's history. If Jesus sees himself as the eschatological prophet, it is hardly surprising that many of his parables point toward the end time. However, to try to make all the synoptic parables speak directly and primarily of the grand history of God's dealing with Israel or the consummation of that history in the coming of the kingdom of God is to force them into too tight a literary straitjacket. For instance, some of the so-called example stories specific to Luke, notably the parable of the Good Samaritan or the Rich Fool, do not operate on such a grand scale. Indeed, some of the parables, like the Rich Fool, blend wisdom themes into the prophetic, as after all did the prophet Amos and or Jeremiah. The synoptic parables do not reflect a Jesus one-note. By the way, as you may have noticed by now, I have purposely kept my definition of synoptic parable as simple and perhaps even as vague as possible. But to summarize, a parable of the synoptic Jesus is a striking short story that employs a metaphor or similitude stretched out into a narrative that is puzzling enough to tease the mind into active thought and personal decision. It is this intentionally unspecific definition of parables that leads us to thesis 5. Thesis 5 states that any attempt to define Jesus' parables in greater detail than my vague definition, that is, any attempt to define the parables with a laundry list of specific essential characteristics, threatens to introduce qualifications that are true of some, but not of all, the synoptic parables. This mistake of over-defining sometimes flows from presuming what is to be proved. A critic will decide prematurely which parables come from the historical Jesus and then proceed, perhaps unconsciously, to define parables in general from the vantage point of the chosen ones. A partial list of such questionable characteristics, or put bluntly, fallacies, includes the following. Fallacy 1 holds that Jesus' parables always draw upon events of everyday peasant life or the cycle of nature in Palestine. Sometimes, not always. Such a description is hardly true of the court intrigue in the parable of the unforgiving servant, high finance at high level, or the wheeling and dealing over big money in the parable of the talents or pounds. It is hardly true of the parable of the wedding feast, when a king, in the midst of final preparations for the banquet of his son, slaughters all the invited citizens from a city that he proceeds to burn to the ground. This sounds more like Game of Thrones than daily peasant life in Palestine. One could easily multiply examples. Fallacy 2 holds, and you hear this almost in all the parable books, Fallacy 2 holds that Jesus' parables are always fictitious narratives. Not always. It is hardly a fiction that in first century Palestine, sowers went out to sow their seed, that various amounts of seed fell in less than optimum soil, and so failed to yield edible produce, while at least in very good years, an abundant harvest would result from the seed that fell on good ground. Granted, Jesus will often employ hyperbole in his stories, but that does not make the basic story fictitious. If hyperbole automatically turned a narrative into fiction, then most yearly reports to the faculty by university presidents and deans would qualify as fiction. Let us not even speak of professors' CVs. The same point holds for the parables of the mustard seed, the leaven, and the seed growing by itself. Apart from some hyperbole, these parables speak of what does in fact happen on a regular basis, and certainly did happen in Jesus' Palestine. Fallacy 3 holds that Jesus' parables are always, or at least usually, subversive of traditional religious beliefs. This is very big in the 1960s and 70s, as you can imagine. That is, the parables upend all traditional religious beliefs with surprise endings or alternatively posing puzzling stories that resist any specific interpretation, very postmodern. Indeed, at times Jesus turns into a postmodern professor or deconstructionist critic, or perhaps a Zen master, not unlike Don Draper at the end of Mad Men. A Zen master intent on bewildering his students in a class on theory or koans or Coca-Cola, maybe. Apart from the obvious anachronisms involved in such a portrait, the claim of fallacy 3 is demonstrably false. For example, the special Lucan parable of the rich fool is Jesus' recycling of a traditional truth inculcated by Old Testament sages and prophets, repeated by intertestamental literature, and even by Greco-Roman popular philosophy of the time. One finds variations on the theme in the book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and especially Ben Sira. Actually, if we imagine Jesus telling the parable of the rich fool to an audience of Jews nurtured on the spirituality of their own scriptures, then Jesus, far from peddling O. Henry surprise endings to subvert traditional religious expectations, actually affirms them. An attack on one's religious world, this parable is not. The same is true of a whole slew of parables, including the sower, the seed growing by itself, the mustard seed, the leaven, barren fig tree, tower builder, and the warring king. Now, to be sure, there are parables with surprise endings. For example, Matthew's parable of the early and late workers in the vineyard, the parable of the Good Samaritan, and the parable of the prodigal son. Those are, we tend to like the ones with the surprise ending, but actually they're in a pitiful minority on the whole. Indeed, I would maintain that a simple counting of parables would show that these surprise ending parables do not typify the synoptic parables in general. In thesis 6, we come to a much more contentious position, but one which is absolutely necessary to get on to the great reveal of thesis 7. So bear with me. In my view, the claim that the parables in the Coptic Gospel of Thomas represent a tradition independent from, and perhaps earlier and more reliable than, the synoptic tradition of parables, that basic claim is, in my view, highly questionable. The argument for thesis 6 needs to be made on both a general and a specific level. The general observations about the Coptic Gospel of Thomas that inclined me to be skeptical were laid out in volume 1 of A Marginal Jew. But these need to be supplemented by detailed exegetical studies of individual sayings. That is why I have undertaken in the last few years a series of essays published in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, the Journal of Biblical Literature, and the Frank Matera Festschrift. But such initial probings are hardly adequate to solve the problem. Hence, in volume 5 of A Marginal Jew, I lay out a more extensive set of probes. To make sure my findings are not distorted by drawing examples from only one stream of the synoptic tradition, I examine sayings from every synoptic source. Mark the hypothetical Q source, Mark Q overlaps, the special Matthean material, the special Lucan material, and at least one case where the same basic unit is found in both special Matthean and special Lucan material. In addition, to ensure that I do not load the dice by focusing on only one or two literary genres or just look at parables, but they might be a special case, to avoid that, a whole range of literary forms is examined as well. Apart from the parables, and before I look at the parables, gospel texts are chosen that exemplify proverbial sayings with an eschatological thrust, wisdom sayings of Jesus, his missionary instructions to the disciples, a beatitude, a Christological statement about Jesus' mission, a saying about the cost of discipleship, and a pronouncement story about his mother and brothers. And purposely, a wild tossed salad of greens of gospel material. 9 such cases, all from outside the parable tradition, are first analyzed, each time with the result that dependence on one or more synoptic gospels seems to be the more likely hypothesis. It is only then that I turn to the literary form of narrative parables, with one example again taken from each synoptic source. For strategic reasons, actually, a few more parables are left to be analyzed in later chapters of Volume 5. But inside this chapter, dedicated to the Coptic Gospel of Thomas, six examples from the parable tradition of Thomas are tested, again with the judgment of dependent being the more likely conclusion. Now, one must be careful about stating the upshot of all this testing. Since I do not test every single saying in Thomas that has a synoptic parallel, that would be about half of the 114 sayings of Thomas, I cannot exclude the possibility that some stray saying in Thomas might come from an independent tradition, though I have yet to run across a convincing argument for a single case of such a phenomenon. My probes aim rather at shifting the burden of proof. After seeing so many cases where Thomas is dependent, both inside and outside the parable tradition, I think it's up to a scholar claiming the independence of a particular saying to provide weighty proof for such a claim. Speaking personally, I'm still waiting to see any such proof for any particular saying. Now, I admit that if I were totally alone in my opinion about Thomas's dependence, I might feel somewhat insecure about my findings. But, as a matter of fact, from the beginning of research on Thomas, various named scholars have taken the dependence position. More importantly, and more recently, two noted experts, Simon Gathacol of Cambridge University and Mark Goodacre of Duke University, have published a series of articles and a number of books now, putting the dependence point of view on very solid ground. Indeed, if you were looking for an exhaustive treatment of the issue, I would refer you to Simon Gathacol's 723-page book, The Gospel of Thomas, Introduction and Commentary, published in 2014. The introductory essays alone are worth the price of admission, but since the book is published by Brill, the price of admission is very high. Brill does not publish books that holds them for ransom. I have spent so much time on Thomas because one's judgment about its dependence on the synoptics is important for my final and most contentious thesis, the one about the big lie, to which all these other six theses have been leading. Thesis 7 brings us, as I say, to my last and perhaps most unsettling claim. In a nutshell, Thesis 7 states that relatively few of the synoptic parables can be shown with a good deal of probability to go back to the historical Jesus. In other words, relatively few of the parables can meet the test of the criteria that all other sayings and deeds of Jesus are supposed to meet. Yet in past research, all too often, unlike other gospel sayings of Jesus, the parables get a free pass. Well, why, apart from, say, piety and nostalgia, do they get such special treatment? In part, at least, I suspect we can credit the enormous influence of the giants of parable research in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially the three big guns, Adolf Ulliker, Joachim Jeremias, and C.H. Dodd. Now, if you think this claim is inflated, I suggest you try a little experiment yourself. Read the first few pages of each author's key book on the parables, and notice the common credo that you find there, the source of the big lie. For example, right at the beginning of his monumental two-volume work, Adolf Ulliker proclaims, and pardon me if I give you a rather literal translation of the German here, quote, "We find no basis for denying the genuineness of the gospel parables in general. On the contrary, we are compelled to attribute to them a relative authenticity. Almost without exception, they have a genuine kernel that goes back to Jesus himself. This principle hardly seems to need a defense." This principle hardly seems to need a defense, end quote. Talk about a preemptive strike. Similarly, Dodd begins his classic work, The Parables of the Kingdom, with the affirmation, quote, the parables are perhaps the most characteristic element in the teaching of Jesus. They have upon them the stamp of a highly original mind. Certainly, there is no part of the gospel record which has for the reader a clearer ring of authenticity, end quote. Not to be outdone, Georg Hever Jeremias declares at the beginning of his famous parable book, The Parables of Jesus, quote, the student of the parables of Jesus may be confident that he or she stands upon a particularly firm historical foundation. The parables are a fragment of the original rock of tradition. In reading the parables, we are dealing with a particularly trustworthy tradition and are brought into immediate relation to Jesus, end quote. Notice how the parables seem to acquire an almost sacramental or Eucharistic quality. We are brought into immediate relation to Jesus. To fast forward to the 21st century, in his recent huge work on the parables, the noted scholar Kyle Snodgrass simply repeats this perennial wisdom flowing from Ulliker and affirmed by most scholars since. Notice in particular the sweeping universal claim of Snodgrass, quote, everyone admits that the parables are the surest source we have of Jesus' teaching, end quote. Apparently, I don't count as part of everyone. Talk about being an outsider. The remarkable thing about these affirmations, and they could be easily multiplied from many other parable books that tend to repeat the masters in one way or another, the remarkable thing about these affirmations is that they all appear at the beginning of the author's book, not at the end. They are not the conclusion of the exegesis laid out in his work. They are the indisputable starting point, the unquestioned presupposition of all that follows. When Canomos hear the insistently repeated credo, credo from Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, here we have the big lie. Need we be surprised that the rest of each of these parable books winds up confirming the stance that the opening pages proclaim with unwavering certitude? As so often turns out to be the case, the supposed quest for the historical Jesus in these books is actually a historically informed Christology. That is to say, a historically informed project of faith seeking understanding about Jesus Christ. Now, a historically informed Christology is an important endeavor, and I applaud it. We need more of it. But it should not be confused with a critical historical quest for the historical Jesus, open in principle to verification by any quester, believer or non-believer alike. Let me be clear. I am not disputing that the historical Jesus used parables in his teaching. We have abundant multiple attestation for that statement, and it coheres perfectly with Jesus' role as prophet and teacher, standing in a tradition that reaches back to the prophets of the Jewish Bible while foreshadowing the metaphors and stories that we'll find in the later rabbis of the Talmud and the Midrashim. Thus, I do not question the fact that Jesus taught in parables, though I would point out that we cannot be sure whether the parables were the most common, most characteristic form of the teaching of the historical Jesus. The reason for that is simple. We are not in a position today to discern the proportion of authentic parable material in relation to the other forms of authentic teaching used by the historical Jesus. But once we descend from this grand general assertion that Jesus taught in parables down to the nitty-gritty particular judgment that this or that specific parable comes from Jesus, we are in trouble. Which criteria of historicity can be invoked to support such a claim? Well, the criterion of multiple attestation of independent sources, namely a couple of independent witnesses, all witnessing to the same parable, that criterion works for very few parables. The mustard seed is the one clear example of a parable preserved in both Mark and Q. In addition, I argue in Volume 5 that the parable of the Great Supper, alias the wedding banquet, and the parable of the talents or the pounds come not from the Q document, but from separate Matthean and Lucan traditions, and hence enjoy multiple attestation. But that, I think, is it for multiple attestation of independent sources. Mark and parables exist in Matthew and Luke because Matthew and Luke copied Mark with changes. Here one can see the importance of deciding that the Coptic Gospel of Thomas, thesis 6, does not represent an independent source for the parables. If Thomas were independent, we would have multiple attestation for 9 more parables. One can appreciate why scholars so different as Joachim Jeremias, Robert Funk, John Dominic Crossan would all rally around the cause of Thomas's independence. It gives them the multiple attestation they need and otherwise lack for 9 key parables. In my view, here the wish is father of the thought, of the consensus, and of the books. You can see the point of thesis 6 then. I was heading them off at the pass. Well then, what are the criteria of embarrassment? As parable research shows, what one clever exegete can make shocking and embarrassing, another can render bland, not to mention homilous. But what of the relatively few cases where shock value seems to be indisputably present because a dubious character is extolled, the dishonest steward, for instance? The problem here is that the prime example of such a clear shock effect, at least for the putative original audience, would be the Good Samaritan, which is a contradiction term for Palestinian Jews at the time. Samaritans were dirty half-breed heretics. The only Good Samaritan was a dead Samaritan, etc. Unfortunately, at least for the poor Samaritan, I spend a good amount of time in Volume 5 arguing that this parable comes neither from Jesus nor from the early Christian tradition, but is a pure creation of Luke himself. Now, be that as it may, in the larger question of argument from embarrassment, Jesus was not the only religious figure in the first century CE capable of making shocking, embarrassing statements. Paul in his epistles and John the Seer in the book of Revelation know how to disturb or repel with their sometimes off-putting imagery. Well, what about the criterion of discontinuity? The distinguished expert on parables, Bernard Brandon Scott, has argued preemptively for an a priori presumption of authenticity for synoptic parables in general. This is very clever. Realizing it's hard to argue about a specific parable, he wants, again, a preemptive action. We can simply presume the parables in general are authentic. Why? Well, it's interesting to look at his argument. I think the argument he uses does not hold up under scrutiny. Contrary to what many Jewish scholars say about their own Jewish scriptures, Scott claims that the parable genre does not exist in the Hebrew Bible. Nathan and Ezekiel will be surprised. Strange to say, Scott's argument is largely based on the fact that the short metaphorical narratives in the Jewish Bible that scholars often call parables do not use the distinctive formula, "it is like," or a similar phrase. But the same absence of like language, I refer to "it is like" rather than liking on Facebook, the same absence of like language is found in many of Jesus' synoptic parables. More often than not, Luke, for example, does not use any introductory formula employing a phrase like "it is like." Indeed, sometimes a Lucan parable is not called a parable by Luke. It is largely due to Matthew's redactional tendency that we automatically associate phrases like "the kingdom of heaven is like" with the parables. Matthew loves to order things and tie them together, so he uses that phrase in chapter 13, his parable chapter. You look sometimes at the Markan or Lucan equivalent, it's not there. A different type of argument from discontinuity takes a more aesthetic, artistic, or romantic approach. Jesus' parables supposedly display greater literary genius than any Jewish parables before or after him. One wonders whether this aesthetic judgment is equally true of the prodigal son and the seed growing by itself, or the sower. On Sunday, when the sowers of the gospel at Mass, you can almost hear the clicking off of the congregation as the sower went out to sow the seed begins. Not all of Jesus' parables are all aesthetic masterpieces. One also wonders whether the rabbis of the Talmud would agree with our aesthetic sense about, would they agree that Jesus' parables are more aesthetic or more gripping than the parables they produce? The greater problem is that at this point, we have strayed into the realm of de gustibus and perhaps of crypto-apologetics. A final form of argument from discontinuity points out that no other writing in the New Testament and in other Christian works of the first and second centuries contain narrative parables similar to those of Jesus. This is certainly true of both Paul and John the Evangelist. The problem with this argument is that it tells us nothing about the creativity of the key players handing on the tradition of the parables in the first decades after Jesus' ministry. Here we should pause and ask ourselves, what are we implying when we claim that a particular parable goes back to the historical Jesus? We are implying that one or more ear witnesses of Jesus' public ministry heard this parable, remembered it, and repeated it in the circle of disciples and then in the early church. The parable continued to be repeated, with no doubt various permutations and oral performances, down to the time it was recorded in one of the synoptics, if not before. Now, are we to suppose that the original disciples, who spent 2 to 3 years listening to and repeating Jesus' parables during his ministry, never learned anything from him about how to construct a striking parable? Was Jesus really so poor a teacher? Or are we to think that the original disciples were as stupid and dense as Mark makes them out to be? The problem with the whole argument from discontinuity when applied to the parables is that we are dealing with a group of tradition bearers who necessarily existed, if any of the parables is authentic, but about whom we know next to nothing. In particular, we know nothing about how creative they were and to what extent they may have composed parables in imitation of the ones they received from Jesus or Jesus' ear witnesses. Well, do any of the other criteria apply? We're getting desperate here. Certainly not the criterion of Jesus' final fate. Some parables may have annoyed some people, but one can hardly imagine the legal accusation placed above Jesus' head on the cross reading, "Jesus of Nazareth, spinner of parables." Pilate couldn't have cared less. As for the criterion of coherence, this criterion highlights the fact that Jesus' use of parables makes sense when placed within the grand tradition that stretches from Nathan to the rabbis. But this tells us nothing about the authenticity of any one particular synoptic parable. In sum, then, very few of the parables can satisfy the criteria of historicity that we expect other sayings of Jesus to satisfy if they are to be judged authentic. Actually, if one reads major commentaries on the parables, one can discern between the lines a tacit, backhanded admission of the situation. Quite often, the question of a parable's authenticity is answered with a blanket observation such as, various interpreters across the spectrum have concluded that this parable is authentic. We all know that because we all repeat the same thing from one another. Thus, we have multiple attestation of modern critics. Alternately, we are told that there is really no good reason to exclude this parable from the proclamation of Jesus, at least no good reason the author can come up with, thus reviving the unsubstantiated presumption in favor of authenticity. The burden of this lecture, of course, is that contrary to Ulrich Adad Jeremias and all the scholars who have accepted their credo, as their own question starting point, there is no such presumption of authenticity. To the question, how do we know that this particular parable comes from the historical Jesus, my answer is that in many cases we don't and we can't. Needless to say, and this is very important, needless to say, I am not claiming that in most cases I can prove the opposite, namely that a particular parable definitely does not come from Jesus, though I think that the Good Samaritan, the wheat and the weeds, and the 10 bridesmaids are good candidates for such proof. Rather, as was often the case when dealing with the miracle tradition in volume 2 of A Marginal Jew, we are left with the galling but honest historical judgment of non liquet, not clear either way. And it's the lack of that middle column of non liquet that damages a great deal of historical Jesus research, that there's the implicit idea that there are only two columns. Either I can prove it's from Jesus or I can't prove it's from Jesus, and which side bears the burden of proof. The idea that an honest historian, after doing a lot of work, might have to come to the honest conclusion, in the end, non liquet. It is not clear either way. Arguments on both sides cancel each other out. There is no ultimate certainty one way or the other. That is what historians have to accept at times. It's horrible after you've done all that work, but that is the honesty of a real historian, instead of deciding, after all this work, we are going to have a decision whether I can prove it or not. No, sometimes we have to accept non liquet, even with the parables. All the consensus to the contrary, a consensus launched and sustained by the enduring work of Ulrika Dodd and Jeremias, splendid books that I still honor and use, I'm not putting them down, all the consensus to the contrary proves nothing. Now, some may find this negative conclusion disappointing. Personally, I think that disappointing or not, a conclusion that speaks the truth to the big lie about parable sets us free, and free in particular to realize why believing Christians continue to accept and revere the synoptic parable, continue to celebrate them in the liturgy, continue to meditate upon them, no matter what a critic may decide about the historical Jesus. I think the answer there lies precisely in an important part of this whole project, namely the living word scripture in the life of the church. The scripture, of course, can be used as a historical source for constructing the historical Jesus. The scripture is much more than that and primarily something else. Christians receive the parables as the word of God, communicated to us through scripture. Hence, the parables are the authentic teaching of Jesus in the deeper sense, be that Jesus during his public ministry speaking this parable, or the risen Jesus speaking this word to us through the Holy Spirit in the church, through the inspired scriptures. That, and not the hypothetical historical reconstructions of a John Dominic Crossan or a John Meyer, is why we continue to treasure the parables as the authentic word of Jesus, teaching us now, just as these parables taught us 2,000 years ago. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That collective scream you heard was graduate students everywhere realizing that in 45 minutes, Father Meyer had undermined their dissertations with this incredible presentation and challenge. Please join us upstairs for some refreshment, and please bring your questions and comments for Father Meyer. Thank you very much for being with us. Yes.
Thank you all very much for coming. I do appreciate your kindness, your great attention during what was a lengthy lecture. Thank you so much.